Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Greg Lake, you ask? Well, simply put, Greg had a stellar career in immigration. Beginning in the policy department, he was quickly promoted through the ranks to operations director at Christmas Island. That sound familiar? It will do shortly. And then the director of a number of onshore detention centres before heading to Nauru. Throughout his career, and particularly when stationed at Nauru, he struggled with moral challenges presented by his job on a day-to-day basis. The treatment of asylum seekers by the Australian government at the heart of it. And joins us now in the Open House studios. G'day, Greg. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Now, let's start just quickly with a potted history of your life. You are a youth worker. You dabbled in the study of theology. You went to banking. How did you end up working for the Immigration Department?
I move around a lot, that's true, I'll grant you that. I ended up with immigration accidentally coming from the bank where I was working in labour market economics. And so that first job you mentioned in the department was looking at skilled migration shortages. That's how I got into immigration. How I got into detention centres was very much an accident.
Okay, step us through that, because that's not a job that I would have thought, having had a quick chat with you, would automatically appeal to you.
Not necessarily, no. Look, I think no one joins immigration in order to run detention centres. A lot of people join immigration for other reasons, and when the department need people to go and work in those detention centres, they call on all the resources they have. I'm not quite sure why they chose me, but I think they look for people who are willing and able to move to remote areas where most of the detention centres are placed, and they're looking for people who've got the kind of leadership skills and relational skills that they need to be managers, but also to take decisions on the run, which often happens.
Did you have a view on the value of a detention centre before working inside one?
If I'm 100% honest, I would say no. I actually hadn't really addressed the issue of detention for myself at all when I took the position. I saw it as a career move, an opportunity to go and see a different part of the world, and I really didn't think about it anything more than in those selfish terms.
You raced through a career at breakneck speed. Like me, you're a child prodigy.
That's not how I describe myself, but sure.
And it's not the way many people describe me either, trust me. But all of a sudden, you must look up and suddenly you're the operations director on Christmas Island. What's an operations director before we go to what comes next?
Yeah, look, I suppose an operations director looks after the largest staff team on the island and works with service providers like the Serco Security Services and Welfare Services, health service providers, and all of those other agencies and organisations to coordinate things like, how do you make sure people have access to food? How do you move people around? How do you respond when a boat shows up at Flying Fish Cove? How do you move people through the immigration process? How do you fly them off the island? Where do you fly them to? Who coordinates the airplane? It's all those really basic fundamental things, right down to how easy is it for someone in detention to access a gym, education services, and medical services.
Forgive me this observation, but it sounds a lot like people are products.
No, they're numbers, not products. I say that tongue-in-cheek in a way. Look, I think you can do that job and treat people as a commodity and treat them as sheep to be herded. But you can also do it in a way that is a lot more humane. And I think you'd ask five people who've done the job and all of them would say they approached it differently. I like to think that one of the wonderful things that came out of my opportunity there as a Christian was being able to actually promote the kind of value for human life that reflects my view of the fact that everyone's created in God's image and therefore are valuable. But it's not an easy thing to do.
Let's go to December 2010 and you get a phone call from the hospital looking for body bags.
Yeah, that was later in the morning. The morning started the way I normally started work, which was to drive down to Flying Fish Cove or one of the coastal points where you can see the ocean. At that time of year, it's the swell season and a lot of activity in the ocean. And I drove down, then went into the office, and it was just like any normal morning. But it was that morning that the boat crash that I'm sure is etched into everyone's memory occurred. As we responded to that, we had no idea how many bodies were going to be pulled out of the water. And so when I got that phone call later that morning from the hospital, it was to say they'd run out of body bags. I knew they had about 20 there. And they were asking if we had any further body bags that we could provide and potentially needed to provide further morgue facilities with some sort of refrigerated shipping container. That's the kind of environment we were working in. It was one of the most difficult phone calls that I received in the job.
Tell me about what you're feeling.
I was already pretty emotionally challenged by that. And when I find myself in a situation like that, my reaction is to go into kind of professional mode, if you like. It seems heartless, but it means that I'm making as best decision as I can and not allowing my emotional state to influence the way that I think methodically through the issues and work out how we can best support whatever's going on. So my role on the day was to coordinate the provision of all sorts of things, from blankets to food to medical services to the response team who were actually pulling people out alive and dead on the beach at Ethel there. And I think it's important, or it was important then, for me to go, okay, I need to put aside my own emotional reaction to this, my own personal political views, and actually do the best I can to provide that support.
What happened when news started to pass through the detention centre that this was going on outside its gates?
News travels fast inside a detention centre, and there were a lot of people who were very concerned that they might have family members who'd been on board the boat. It's very, very difficult to not encourage people to get more worked up than they need to be. And so one of the things I found challenging in that situation was the decision taken by the operations team in Canberra, or my bosses, if you like, not to inform people in the main detention centre at Northwest Point of the identity of the victims until those victims had been formally identified by one of the AFP identification teams, which takes sometimes days. And in that case, it took quite a few days in sometimes weeks. And that was very challenging because you know that there's a chance that it's their wife and child that's died, but you can't tell them that they're on board or if they were definitely there or where the boat left and who was. There's very little information you could hand out, and that was very difficult to withhold that kind of info, but sometimes that's in the best interests.
It sounds like that's a decision that's based on compassionate grounds. Where does the line between authority and compassion begin and end?
If you could answer that question, you would probably have solved a lot of the ethical challenges that I uncovered. And I think you would make a public servant, an immigration officer's life a lot more difficult. It's very hard to know at what point do you withhold information or, frankly, say one thing that may not be wholly true in order to look after the needs of a person. But I suppose my whole challenge with the environment was we should never have to do that. Why are we even in a position where we're required to make a judgment about potentially lying to someone because that's better than the alternative? We've obviously gone so far in one direction that questions, a line like that should never be approached in a public environment like that.
It sounds like the wrestle was well and truly on for you on the issue of my faith and humanity and the way we share with each other. We are a lucky country. We have plenty of space. We've got ways to support people. At this point, are you starting to decide whether we're supporting people in the right way? And have you now decided a view on detention centres?
In December 2012, I would say I was still very much in the beginning of my thinking and spent really the next few years working through the question of, or a couple of years, working through the question of, is this the sort of job that having Christians there will actually improve the circumstances for vulnerable people? Or would it be better perhaps for me to just walk out and leave like I ended up ultimately deciding? And I think I've definitely formed a view on detention, at least detention in the offshore sense for sure. I think detention centres can be run and managed well onshore if done properly, but I think it should be short-term detention, and I don't think that's what we typically see. I think the issue of, you know, can you ever really do this well, and do we as a lucky country treat asylum seekers right, is a really hard one, because I know that the Australian community is divided over. And I suppose what I say in response to that is asylum seekers aren't all perfect, and there are a lot of advocates out there who will say they're angels. I don't believe that. I believe that asylum seekers, some of them are really horrible people. Some people are using the system. In my experience, the vast majority are not. But the reality is there are some bad eggs, if you like. But at the end of the day, we're all like that. We're all, to a degree, corrupted before God and worthy nonetheless of of anyone's grace. And I think that just because someone's not perfect doesn't mean they're not vulnerable. And I think that's an important thing to remember when it comes to our treatment of these people who, right or wrong, have arrived on our shores.
Greg Lake is with us this afternoon and more than willing to have a chat with you. 1-300-40-2020. Yesterday's challenge was find out more about life as an asylum seeker, as a refugee. Here's your chance to do so. Give us a buzz. You can also be a part of the conversation online through Open House Community on Facebook and hashtag Open House Live. 1-300-40-2020. 1300 40 20 20. Is there a perspective that you would like to hear filled in from Greg Lake in person? We can do that with you now. Let's go on to your career after Christmas Island. And there are so many legs to what happens to your life after this point that we do need to skim over a few of them. I'd much rather a longer conversation. But let's move on. You move around a little bit more. And then as Prime Minister Julia Gillard comes into power, focus turns to Nauru. And you end up there.
I ended up working on Nauru before I ended up there, if you know what I mean. I was working in Canberra to actually establish both the centre on Nauru and in Manus, working at the Canberra end, though, not actually on site. And yes, then they sent me up to Nauru as the director of the centre, the most senior immigration officer on the island. That was interesting. Nauru is a fascinating place. I describe it as being like the Easter Island, the modern-day Easter Island of our time. And I think that's because in some ways it's a failed state that really only still exists as a country because of Australian government money, both through this detention thing and also through aid that's sent to Nauru. But Nauru is a failed state in that the outside circle of the island is populated and the inside is desolate. And it's in that internal inside section where they built this detention centre, which is surrounded by what they describe as pinnacles, which are these kind of rocks that are dangerous to walk over. It's kind of like a tropical version of a glacier. You'd fall down a crevasse without noticing if you're not careful. And that's where we decided it was a good place to put vulnerable people.
Were you part of that decision?
Not to send them to Nauru. That was a decision taken by the government. But in terms of the decision of where to locate the centre on the island, I was involved in the design and location of the centre. But ultimately, it's a decision taken by the government. Yeah. They have to make that call.
So this sounds like a most unhospitable place. It's not designed to be an inviting location.
It's really not.
It's about a message by the sound of it. So you end up in this place, it's chosen, and you start to run it. What are the differences between Nauru? Because detention centres, regardless of where they are, would seem to blur in our consciousness. It sounds to me like they are very different locations. Christmas Island versus Nauru. What's the structure like at Nauru?
When I arrived, Nauru's facilities, the buildings, were still very temporary. They were basically tents for most of the environment. While I was there, we oversaw quite a few new buildings being occupied. So people were moving from tents into permanent facilities, which have since been burnt down. But there's a whole other discussion there.
Yeah.
But look, to be honest, the Nauru Detention Centre's final product, the end design, is a world-class detention facility, if I can say that. And there are people who spend their time working out how to design detention facilities to create certain behaviours and things. And if you like, Northwest Point on Christmas Island is designed for that. And when it's overcrowded, its ability to be humane is lost. So while Northwest Point at Christmas Island is overcrowded, it's terrible. When it's not overcrowded, it actually has a lot of good services that it can provide. Nauru will get to that point. It hasn't yet. There's been a few setbacks, as we've mentioned already. Yeah. But look, it's a place that's very, very difficult for someone to live in. When I was there, there were people living in tents that were unair-conditioned. They were cramped in with a lot of people, sometimes 12, 15 to a tent. It rains a lot. It's tropical, so you get the afternoon tropical rains. It's wet, muddy. There's very limited place for people to go and play football or soccer. And there's really just not a lot to do. And when you take that sort of environment and insert people who've got no hope, no sense that if I do these things, I'm going to end up over there somewhere, if you take away that hope and then put them in an environment like that, it's a recipe for disaster. So none of what's happened on Nauru, or for that matter in Manus, has surprised me.
I want to talk about one of the requests that came from the government of the time and a particular need, a particular family that you were to locate. And I want to talk about hopelessness and what we can do about that when it comes to detention centres, if it sounds like we're going to continue to use these facilities in the near term. 1300 40 20 20. Greg Lake, immensely experienced in the running of detention camps, detention centres. We're talking about asylum seekers and refugees. Here is a man who's seen it firsthand, has been instrumental in many decisions, has left the Immigration Department since, so has no obligation to shelter truths or otherwise. 1300 40 20 20. Greg, you're at Nauru and you're asked by the government of the time to seek out a specific family for a specific reason. What was that reason?
All right, I was actually not on Nauru at the time of this. However, the government really set up offshore processing to demonstrate that coming to Australia was worse, or was going to be worse for you, than staying in Indonesia. So if you think about it in the context of someone who's fled a country that's typically war-torn, they've often seen members of their family raped and killed in front of them. Horrific stories. They've travelled through a number of countries and arrived in Indonesia, and they've got the choice, whether they can get on a boat or stay where they are. And what the government wanted to do was say, stay where you are. And that means don't bring your kids, don't bring your wife, just stay in Indonesia or go somewhere else, don't come to Australia. So we were trying to find a family, and I got a direction from the minister's office, from the political staff who are responsible for this whole issue. And she said, I want you to find a family who've got the youngest child possible, that looks the youngest, so that we can send them to, it was actually Manus, and we want to use them as an example, effectively, and say, look, if you bring your children, you'll still get sent to Manus Island. And that kind of thing happened commonly, but this for me was huge because I had to then go through and select a family. And we couldn't send anyone with children under 7 at the time because of issues to do with inoculation against some of the diseases present in PNG. So we needed to find a 7-year-old or a family with a 7-year-old who looked young. So I went through, and not knowing the people individually, but seeing their photos, and went, look, this is the family who I think are probably best going to achieve the political purposes. Now, those families, that family were effectively pawns in a political system. They're real people, but from the government's perspective, it was about sending that strong message to people smugglers and people in Indonesia, don't get on a boat, it's not worth it.
Do you know what happened to that family?
They were transferred to Manus. I know that I believe the family have since been brought back to Australia, and I'm not sure if they've then been sent to Nauru. But I haven't kept up with that individual family because it's not really my place to do that now.
What we're talking about here is situation ethics at its worst. The idea behind sending a family is to convince other families not to come. There seem to have been a great many of these kinds of decisions. What is the message that we can send to stop other people from making a bad choice? And yet the premise underneath all of that is that you have no right to come here in the first instance. Is that a fair summation of the reality of the situation?
I think the idea that people don't have the right to come to Australia except on our terms as Australians and as a country is very real in the hearts and minds of many Australians. And I think it's that brings us into conflict over this issue, because we say we don't want people getting on boats, partly because of a compassionate thing. We don't want them to drown. And I've seen that, so I know that that's a bad thing. But partly because we want to maintain that control over our border. We've always controlled our border in Australia. And when people threaten it on a boat, even if they don't affect my life, they threaten something about what it means to be in Australia. I think that's that's where a lot of the passion comes from, saying we need to stop the boats. And I understand that. I think I can acknowledge that that's real. I think we need to question that all the time. But that's what underpins these political decisions, saying we need to do anything and we'll stop at nothing to protect and maintain our right to choose how you arrive. And I think there are people out there for sure who take a position like we need to stop people, we need to create a no-advantage policy in order to have some sort of compassion. But I think there's something more complex to it for people.
Is there a place for detention centres? And if so, under what circumstances and how should they be run?
There's absolutely a place for detention centres. I don't think anyone can really say there's not. However, those detention centres ought to be short-term, administrative, and they should not be for the purposes of creating a disincentive to arrive. We need to create those disincentives some other way, by providing alternatives that are real to people, or by looking at other kinds of disincentives that are not inhumane. And that's a challenge, don't get me wrong, but you're asking about detention centres. Look, if somebody arrives in the country, we don't know them, we don't know them well, we do need an opportunity to at least sit down and ask them some questions. If only because a detention centre provides an environment where we can actually provide people with that immediate medical care they need when they've stepped off a boat.
Do they?
Often. The number of people who step off a barge at Christmas Island and require fairly immediate, within 12 hours, medical attention, sometimes quite acute, is very, very common.
Do we emotionally and spiritually support people who are inside detention centres?
I don't think we do it well. I think some people try hard. I think the environment allows for that if we chose to do that. In other words, I think we can give access to people to religious services. I think we can give access to people to emotional support. And I think as long as detention is short-term and temporary and there's a view as to how you're going to get out, people won't lose hope while they're there. So I think it is possible, but I think we're failing in that now.
So taking hope away from people who take the journey in the first instance, is that a cure to the problem?
The reality is, if you make it that bad for people in Australia that they realise it's worse to go than to stay in Indonesia or their home country, people will stop coming, but it will come at the cost of lives. In fact, it already has. If that's something that Australia as a country is willing to swallow and bear responsibility for, that lots and lots of people will die because of its, effectively, its inhumane policy, then yes, it will work. But I don't think we're ready to do that, or certainly I'm not.
We were called to find out more about detention centres and the life of an asylum seeker. There is no standardised asylum seeker. There's no standardised refugee. But make some of these people real for us in the next couple of minutes, will you? Who are these people? Tell me about what it is that's motivated them and why it is we should have a close, hard look at the way we meet them, wherever they are.
I'll tell you about a guy called Raj, who's probably one of the most impressive asylum seekers I met, who's a pastor in Sri Lanka. He's a Tamil. He's now in WA and runs a church over there. He saw his family, his extended family, murdered in front of him as part of the war, and fled the country and has wounds all over his torso where he's been macheted. His experience of running for his life is literal. It's not figurative. He ran for his life and was very fortunate to meet somebody who had enough to provide him with a place on a boat that brought him to Christmas Island, where he went through all the legitimate processes, was found to be a genuine refugee under the convention, and ultimately, after quite a long time in detention, close to 18 months, was released into the Australian community and now contributes a wonderful, wonderful ministry over in his church in WA. But here's a guy whose whole focus, his whole life when you meet him, is just about sharing the story of hope that he knows with everybody he meets. And yet he does that out of such adversity that he really puts to shame any kind of persecution that I might think as an Australian I face. He literally had people killed for their faith in front of him at his church service. And you think, this is a pretty impressive guy, but he's just a guy. He's actually just your typical Sri Lankan Tamil who just happened to be a church pastor. I'll give you another story. There's another guy who was an Afghan who was one of two Christians in rural Afghanistan. They became Christians when two American missionaries literally travelled through the area, shared the gospel and moved on the next day. And these guys went, wait, that's something that's important to us. And they had to keep their faith under wraps for fear of being killed, but realised they couldn't stay and be Christians. So they left because they felt they were, both by being Hazaras and also by being Christians, very much targets for the Taliban. And so they ran. They left across the border into Pakistan, where they spent some time trying to live, trying to find a way to have a job. But Hazaras can't get a job in Pakistan, especially if they're illegal. Illegal in Pakistan, I mean. And eventually they borrowed the money to travel with a people smuggler and came to Australia. They owe that money to the people smuggler. And often people smugglers will threaten them and threaten their families, and for that matter, actually kill members of their family back home if they're not paid in time. So all these things about people not being out of work might sound good because it doesn't undercut an Australian job, sure, but it also means people who have a debt to a people smuggler can't pay the people smuggler, and the people smuggler will kill their family.
And those debts exist after you pass through the detention centres and come out the other side.
In fact, those debts are often called in before you're even outside the centre.
1300 40 2020. Anna, good afternoon.
Hi there.
Anna, Greg's with us. You have a question on more humane solutions for processing asylum seekers.
Yeah, I was just wondering, Greg seemed to indicate that there are other options out there that we could be putting in place for refugees or asylum seekers. And I thought perhaps I'd read somewhere about some countries who actually have them in their homes while they're being processed. And I don't know about that ever happening here, but I wondered if there were some, perhaps, models overseas that we could replicate here in Australia.
Yeah, Anna, look, thanks for the question. There actually has been a program in Australia where people were invited to host asylum seekers while they were being processed in their homes. And so they'd have them there, they were paid a small allowance. It was organised through the Australian Homestay Network. It was actually quite a successful program for a number of reasons, and it obviously avoids those issues of institutionalisation that you get in detention centres. The problem was we didn't have enough volunteers who would take them in their homes to, I guess, look after all the people who were arriving at the time. So it's a bit of a, you know, if we had enough, it would be a wonderful, wonderful model. But I think we probably need a few models and a few different ideas, and we need to be creative about how we think of those sorts of, those very sorts of things. There aren't very, sorry, go on.
No, good, keep going.
I was just going to say, look, there aren't actually that many other countries who also face the kind of challenges we face here. There's lots of people who, lots of countries that have boats arriving like we do, but a lot of those countries don't use a detention policy. They will provide immediate care very short term, and then they'll move them out into the community with various sorts of support services. And I think those are the sorts of models that we need to look at.
Thanks for your call, Anna.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye. That's really helpful.
Thanks for being a part of Open House. Sylvia, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well. Greg Lake is with us. Ask away.
Hi, Greg. Look, I just wanted to ask about the common understanding that a lot of refugees who come to Australia are Muslims. I've heard a lot of Christians say we should be bringing Christian refugees as opposed to Muslim refugees. So I was wondering if you could give us some clarity if that's true. And if they are Muslim refugees, how can we as Christians serve them? Or should we?
Yeah, great question, Sylvia. Look, the reality is a lot of asylum seekers who do arrive in Australia, both by plane and on boats, are Muslims, but not all of them. There's a very, very sizable Christian population in the Sri Lankan community. There's quite a few, there's other religions represented for that matter across each of the what we describe as cohorts or nationalities that arrive. I mean, my view of the gospel is that Jesus doesn't say, you know, the gospel's only for Christians. In fact, he says, you know, I came to heal the sick, not the well. I think my view, and look, this is my view, I understand it's not going to be shared, is that we should welcome with open arms anybody because that opens doors for those opportunities to share the gospel. I think by providing access to religious services and protecting our right as Christians to share the gospel in a country like Australia is really fundamental to how we manage an issue like this. If we can't share our faith with people in detention, people in the community, and actually welcome with open arms people of any faith so that we might build those relationships, I think we're going to really lose opportunities for the gospel.
Good of you to call, Sylvia. Thank you.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Bye. Open House around Australia. Greg, we're out of time. It's the beginning of a whole bunch of conversations I'd love to continue having with you over these next few open houses. Thank you for joining us. You've given us valuable food for thought. And is there one piece of homework you can give us as listeners right now on ways that we can best impact this broader debate?
Probably. I think the thing that I think needs to underpin all of our understanding when we think about the issue of asylum seekers is, does Jesus value people? Are people important? And if they're fundamentally important, how do we build a response to the asylum seeker issue that reflects that? If we don't believe they're important, then we can just throw them onto another country and forget them. But if we think they're important, we need to think more cleverly and clearly about that.
Where can we find out more about the work that you're doing?
I'm writing a blog at the moment at theimmigrationblog.com, but it's not the only place you can hear about these issues. There are a number of church organisations. There's a conference, as you know, coming up, the Rethinking Conference in Sydney in March, later this month. Rethinking.com.au if you wanted to find out more. But there are lots of resources out there for Christians who are interested in engaging in this issue more, both through their local church organisations and through blogs like that.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.